Okay, so welcome back to the Sustainable Ag Writer. I am here with Ian Bennett, who is with Southern Sayre. And Ian, you're new, so I don't remember your title.
Yeah, that's just fine. I'm the communications specialist.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us here on the podcast today. First of all, tell people a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So I grew up in South Georgia. Valdosta would be the what I like to call the big town around where I live. That's what most people would have heard of. But I grew up about 20 minutes north of the Georgia-Florida line. So I come from, I guess you could say, a farming background. I don't live on a farm, never have. But my grandfather was a sharecropper for most of his life. My family still owns 150 acres of the land that he used to sharecrop. And we have purebred registered Charolais cows on that land. It's still in my family. We still farm it. But my dad is actually the local veterinarian. So we move, not to say that we live in town, because that sounds kind of corny almost, but we just don't live on the farm. I grew up in a neighborhood, rode a school bus with other kids that grew up in a neighborhood, but was always really connected to ag, always really involved, just because it was something that my family did.
Yeah, and Valdosta is a big agricultural area, isn't it?
It is. So there's a lot of fruits and vegetables that are grown in South Georgia. And it's kind of interesting and unique, too, that when you talk about most of America, the two big crops that people rotate through are corn and soybeans. And where I live, it's cotton and peanuts, which is very different. It's really cool that I live in such a unique agriculture area. I had the opportunity to serve as a national FFA officer with the Future Farmers of America a couple of years ago, and traveled all over the country, spent 327 days of that year on the road. I went to 37 states, most of which I had never been to.
Wow.
And even after that, I would say that, you know, the area that I grew up in and the number of different crops that people grow, it's probably as diverse an area of anywhere in America, probably outside of the Central Valley of California.
Yeah, but people don't realize how much we grow down in the Southwest Georgia region. This is just, I always like to tell people that if you have a jar of peanut butter in your pantry, chances are it's got Georgia peanuts in it, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I think 80% of America's peanuts are grown within a 300-mile radius of each other.
Wow.
Which is pretty insane. Yeah, it's like Southwest Georgia and then Virginia, and that's where the vast majority of our peanuts come from.
Yeah. So today we're going to be talking about Southern Sayre. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about what Southern Sayre is?
Yeah, I think Southern Sayre is probably one of the coolest programs that the USDA has. It was something that I wasn't super familiar with before I started working here, but it does a lot of really good work, and it does a lot more variety of things than people really realize. So it started as a part of the Farm Bill back in 1985, but really didn't kind of get up off the ground and running until about 1988. That's the first year they started putting out grants and doing some work with people outside of the USDA. And so it's like it says, it does sustainable agriculture research and education. So to do that, it kind of has five major grant programs. And then all of that information that they research and collect through the grant programs, they give out to people, and that's the education side of things. So the grant programs are a little different in, depending on what region that you're in. Here in the southern region, our five grant programs are the Research Education Grant Program. We have an on-farm research program. We have a producer grant program. And now I'm going to skip one that I started listing them off the top of my head. We have a graduate student grant program and a professional development grant programs. And so those obviously are all designed to do different things and kind of touch different areas of agriculture. But then to get that information out to people, we have a state coordinator in every state in the southern region. And that also includes Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, who have their own coordinators. And so we work pretty closely here at the regional office with those state coordinators. And they have their own budget, their own ability to plan and host different events, depending on you know, kind of what goes on in their state. Obviously, agriculture in Texas is very different than agriculture in Georgia, which is very different than agriculture in Puerto Rico. So we have a lot of flexibility within the system to allow those state coordinators and the people within each state to kind of do what they need to do to help other people and get that information out there.
So one of the things that you always hear people say about the SARE program is how farmer focused it is, that it's really driven by farmers. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it definitely is. It's interesting coming through the USDA. You'd think it would be a lot more scientists and researchers and kind of focused on that. And to an extent it is. But even on our administrative council, I would say probably half of our administrative council are farmers and ranchers. And so, there's a huge emphasis on, you know, not only do we need to figure out how to make agriculture more sustainable in America, but that information needs to get into the hands of farmers. And we also need to be doing things that they want us to do. Like there's, in a lot of sense, there's no point in reinventing the wheel to try to help a farmer do something if they have no intention of doing that to begin with. And so by having farmers and ranchers involved, all the way from the administrative council to selecting our grant programs for the year, to the outreach efforts that go on across the region, we really are focusing and involving farmers in every step of the process. And I think that goes a long way in the impact of what we do. Because not only do we have farmers helping run the programs and selecting the research that we want to do, but then they also are going out and saying, you know, this is good information. These aren't crazy people from whatever office building and wherever. Like, they actually know what's going on. We've been involved in this the whole time, and you should listen to what we have to say. And so, yeah, having farmers and ranchers involved in this program is a huge part of what we do.
Okay, you've mentioned administrative council several times. Can you explain a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, so in the Southern SARE region, we have an administrative council that kind of runs things. So we have the staff, which kind of do the day-to-day things of putting out the press releases and making sure budgets are filled out correctly. But then we have the administrative council that kind of does a lot of the overarching work in setting the direction of what we do. And so the administrative council meets twice a year. There are specific seats on the administrative council. So some of those are set aside for farmers and ranchers. Some of those are set aside for representatives from land-grant universities. And on our website, if you go to Southern SARE, you can look at all of the people who are on the administrative council and what they do. But within the council itself, within our two kind of big yearly meetings that we have, we break ourselves out into different committees, and those different committees kind of do research on what's going on. So we have like a communications committee. We have committees that work with, you know, how do we expand our outreach into groups that we're not meeting now? So like we have an equity and prosperity committee that focuses a lot on that. And so through that committee system and through having all those different groups involved, it just kind of allows us to focus on a broad scale of what our program does and allows us to move forward and make as much impact as we can.
Okay. And one of the things that people always talk to me about Southern SARE is the wide range of educational materials that you have available. Could you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, that's the great thing about being publicly funded is all of the information and all of the research that we have is owned by the citizens of the United States of America. So it's all put out for free. If you go to our website, southern.sare.org, we have a resources and learning section on the website that you can find in the top right-hand corner. And there's an insane amount of information on there that I think people, while they utilize it, I would strongly encourage you to look at it frequently. Because all of these grants, all of this information that we gather and collect, it ends up on this website, at the very least. It ends up in a lot of places, but this is like the home and the house for it. So you can sort it a lot of different ways. You can look for different formats. It's like maybe you're looking for a book on something. Like you don't know anything about soil and you want to start. You can find whole books on soil on this website for free. You can download them as a PDF. If you want a physical copy of a book, we can get those to you as well. You might have to pay just the shipping cost and kind of getting that to you, but we can definitely make that happen. If you want a video, if you want a podcast, if you're trying to look for like a short bulletin, you know, maybe you want to learn some more about cover crops, but you're not trying to read a whole book on it. You can sort it by format. You can find all that information. You can sort it by category. So if you want to find stuff about livestock, you can sort it by region. So if you're only trying to find information from the southern region, you can sort it that way as well. It's a huge amount of information. It covers a lot of really good stuff. Yeah. And I would strongly encourage people to spend some time going through our website and looking at that information. Yeah. We collect, I guess, statistics and facts from different people from time to time. And, you know, people who have looked at this information and read it, they say that they have, if, generally speaking, the math breaks down to, they have a 50% chance of learning something that improves the way they farm, like looking at this information. So in a sense, if you read two pages of information on this website, one of those pages is probably going to help you improve your farm in some way. You're going to be really hard pressed to find anywhere else that you can do that.
Yeah. And the information is easily accessible to like the layman. You know, you could pick up the cover crop book and really get a really good understanding of cover crops. You had mentioned the southern region. So talk a little bit about how SARE is structured, how there's four regions.
Yeah, so like I said, the SARE program was created through the Farm Bill, which is money set aside by the federal government. And so to cover the whole country, they broke things out into four regions. They have a north central region, a northeast region, a southern region, and a western region. And those are generally speaking divided out by state is kind of how they split it apart. Like Guam is a territory, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands are territories, but they're included in that as well. So here in the southern region, we're 13 states and Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. And so it's generally speaking from Texas up to Virginia and then down into the Caribbean a little bit with Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. Okay. So kind of your classic southeast picture that you get in your head, that's the southern region.
Yeah, and from when, what's different from a lot of USDA agency, it's not, SARE is not really a USDA agency per se, correct? It's really run by a land grant in each of the regions.
That's correct. So here at UGA, or here at Southern SARE, we're housed on the UGA Griffin campus, so the University of Georgia. And then those coordinators within each state that I was talking about earlier, those are all members of land-grant universities. I believe they're all professors. I could be incorrect about that, though, but they're definitely all associated with land-grant universities.
And in the South, we're kind of lucky because we have just about two land-grants in each state. And I believe there's a SARE coordinator at each of those land-grant universities. Is that correct? Both the 1862s and the 1890s?
I believe so, yeah. Mm-hmm. So people aren't familiar with the difference between an 1862 and an 1890 land grant. When they first created land grant universities, was obviously in 1862. So that was kind of prior to around the time of the Civil War when a lot of these were getting set up. And so they went back in 1890 and created another set of land grant universities. And I believe most of those are what you would call historically Black colleges, but not every historically Black college and university is an 1890 land grant. So like Tuskegee is one that we work with pretty closely, which is not an 1890 land grant university, but it is a historically Black college and university. But they have an agriculture program, so we do a lot of work with them as well. And then there's also 1990 land grant universities, or 1992, I think it's
94 is, I think you're thinking of
94.
Yeah.
And so those are for Native American tribes. In the southern region, there's only one that we work with. It's out in Oklahoma, but when you get out into the western region of North Central, there's a lot more of those, and they do a lot of great work as well, and work really closely with those in other regions. That's just not something we have a lot of in our region.
Yeah, I think they have as many 1994s as we have 1890s here in the South. So it sort of balances out as you move across the country. So before we talk about the two grants, I wanted to have you on to talk about who's eligible to apply for a Southern Center grant?
Depending on the grant, pretty much anybody is eligible. So we have some specific grants, like our graduate student grants. You need to be a graduate student to apply. But generally speaking, if you're involved in agriculture in some way, whether you're doing research or you're doing education, we probably have a grant program that fits your needs.
Okay, and I believe SARE is one of the few programs that actually give direct funding for farmers, where farmers can actually apply for grants.
I believe so. A lot of the other grants, while they may help farmers, they're not giving them the same kind of direct funding to do actual farming work in the same sense that SARE has the ability to do.
Okay, so you have two major grant programs open right now. One is the research and education, and one is the education. So let's take apart those two grants program. So let's talk about the R&E, the research and education grants programs first.
Yeah, so a research and education grant program was the first one that we started with in 1988. And at the time, it was the only truly dedicated sustainable agriculture grant that you could apply for. Specifically, if you were involved in like a land grant or higher education, there really wasn't much out there at the time. And so it's been our longest running grant program. This past year in the Southern region, we awarded 16 research and education grants. For a little under $3.5 million. So they're significant size grants. They do a lot of really good work. And the important part is what I like to call the and education part at the end. Even though these researchers are doing research, they're also doing education alongside of it. So there's a huge component of getting this information into the hands of people who can use it. But it is kind of, it's also separated out onto the just the education side. So over time, one of the things that we realized was that, while universities do a lot of great research, there's a lot of nonprofits and non-government organizations that do a lot of educational research, or do a lot of educational work. They don't necessarily do strictly research, though. So we did kind of separate off the education grant and make it its own thing. However, that application all runs congruently, just to make it easier to keep track of. So there is a few small differences between the two. The biggest one is in terms of funding. So for a research and education grant, you can receive funding to up to $400,000 over a 3-year period. If you're doing strictly an education grant, it would be $50,000. But the big thing about the education grants is that they take a systems research approach to how they conduct their research. Which is very different than a lot of other grants and a lot of other research that takes place. Most research is what's called component research. And so they're focusing on one specific component of how something works and trying to improve that. The way I like to explain it to people is if you're trying to make a race car faster, most people would focus on just the tires or just the engine or just taking weight out of the seats. But here at Southern Sayre, we're focusing on the whole thing. We want to make the whole race car faster. We want to make all sustainable agriculture better. So if you're focusing on vegetables, if you're doing research on, or I'll use a recent grant. So one of our big grants we were awarded last year is on regenerative grazing and how can we use grazing to improve the soil. So they're not focusing on, how do we use this one breed of cover crop or this, how do we focus on Bahia grass and make Bahia grass better? They're looking at all types of grasses all across the southeast, all different ways to manage grazing. What's the best one out there? How do we improve all of them? As the system as a whole, we want to improve that rather than just one small part. And that's one of the big things about these grants is that they make all of agriculture more sustainable, not just one specific thing that they're focusing on.
Gotcha. And could you name a couple of other types of projects that's been funded under the R&Es, under the R and research and education?
Yeah, let me pull up our list. So this is our list for 2021. Like I said, we had 16 grants for $3,400,000, so almost $3.5 million. And so one of them was looking at using chickpeas. So one of the interesting things about chickpeas, it has a lot of the same nutrient requirements of tobacco. And obviously, we don't grow or use as much tobacco in America as we used to. And so it is a good alternative crop to grow in areas where tobacco can be used.
Chickpeas used, like what you find in hummus?
Yeah, so that's what makes hummus, but you can also use it as a cover crop.
Okay.
And so they're looking at that as a whole across the Southeast, just through the University of Florida. They're trying to find how can we improve chickpeas? What's the best way to grow them? Where do they grow best? What kind of nutrients do they need? That kind of thing. Another one, so we've done a lot of work on Harris property in improving that. So we had an education grant on helping people secure the rights to their land. So Harris property it's an interesting problem to have, and it's not an easy problem to solve.
Mm-hmm.
So we've done a lot of work, especially in the last couple of years, on trying to people solve that. And a lot of that is knowing information ahead of time, and how do we prevent this from happening. And so that's what that grant focuses on. We have some pasture-raised beef. So at the School of Medicine at Duke University, they're studying pasture-raised beef versus conventionally raised beef, or beef that's fed more grain than grass.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at the health differences between the two.
Mm.
So it really does cover a large variety of different topics. But again, I would send you to the website if you're curious about the different grants that we do.
Yeah.
We have a database, and you can search all of our grant programs.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to mention that. You can. And if even if you're not interested in applying a grant, that's a great site to go to just to look for information. You know, it's a great resource. The education grants, can you talk a little bit about some of the grants that you funded in that area? I know you mentioned the Ayers property.
Yeah, so the education grants are a little different because they're mostly nonprofits, non-governmental organizations. And there will be some kind of state extension in people who do the education grants. Let me find one from last year. So we had one that worked with farmers doing direct sales. And this one specifically focuses on the difference between what happened before the pandemic, during the pandemic, and then after the pandemic. So farmers who work with direct sales usually do a lot of like farmers markets. They might have things set up on their own farm. And obviously that has changed a lot over the last year. So that's who the Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Project. And they're doing work to educate people on, you know, this is what we've seen work. This is what kind of has to change just based on the way the world is. And this is some ways to get around that. There's an educational program through the University of Puerto Rico, but it is specifically education on sheep and goats, and just to kind of educate the people on some different ways to raise them and kind of the best practices that we have at the moment. We funded an online course. It's video based and it teaches people how to save seed, which is important for a lot of different reasons. But it's an interesting thing. It's kind of obscure knowledge if you don't know how to save seed properly. It doesn't really last. So that's an education program that we have last year as well.
There's a lot of interest in that now too. So how do people go about applying for these grants?
So the first thing would be to head to our website and go to our grants page. And it will show you the grants that are open at the moment. So at the moment, we have graduate student grants and the research and education grants that are open. You can click on those, and it will pull you to its own web page that has all of the information about that grant. And I would start by reading that web page. It will tell you everything you need to know about the next steps. But generally speaking, there is a application that you have to fill out, and that application is submitted. It's reviewed by our administrative council and our grant reviewers. And then depending on the grant project, some of them have a pre-proposal process and then a full proposal process.
Can you explain the difference between the two of those?
Yeah, so that's for our larger grants to get more applicants. Obviously, a grant application is just kind of a detailed and time-consuming thing. So we would hate for people to have to go all the way through that process and then you know, take all that time and effort to fill it out and then not get the grant. Obviously, not everybody's going to get the grant, but the pre-proposal process allows you to kind of give us some more general information, kind of explain what you'd like to do. And then through our grant reviewers and through our administrative council, we can sit down and say, yeah, this is a good idea. We like what you're saying so far. Go ahead and fill out the whole application, send it back to us, and then we'll put it all the way through our process. Just because it kind of streamlines, it keeps us from having to go through 200 full grant applications at one time. Mm-hmm. That way we can kind of narrow down the scope of what we're looking for.
Yeah, and I guess if you're a smaller organization with not a lot of capacity, that makes it a little bit easier. You don't have to put a bunch of resources there to put together a full-blown grant. You could just see if your idea has some merit. So I know RNEs and the grants that you mentioned are open now. What are the deadlines?
Yeah, so for the research and education grants, the call for pre-proposals, so this is one that kind of has that two-step process. Mm-hmm. It opened in March, so these grants are already open. We're already accepting applications. Mm-hmm. We will continue to accept applications until June, and then that part of the process closes. By August, we will let people know who submitted an application if they moved on to the second step, to the full proposal process. Then by November, those are due. And then by February, we will let people know, we make an official announcement and say, these are the research and education grants for the next year. And then we'll start over. So in February of this year, we announced the research and education grants for 2021. The ones that we're accepting applications for on right now will be awarded for the year 2022.
Right. Okay. So people need to understand that this would be 2022 money. You're not going to get this funding if you're successful this year. So could you talk a little bit about the review process? A lot of people don't know what happens once they hit submit and submit that grant.
Yeah, absolutely. So our grant review process is fairly straightforward. In the sense that people submit an application and then we have grant reviewers that review the grants. And when they review them, they're looking for some specific things. So obviously they need to fit the category of grant that they applied for. And then within that, the method that they use, particularly if it's research, the method that they're using to do whatever their goal is pretty important. So like we said, the systems research is a big deal. It needs to kind of cover the whole system, not just a component of it. They're also looking at the budget. So, you know, one of the things you're required to submit a budget for these grants, and they will take a look at that and say, yeah, this is pretty close. Obviously, it doesn't have to be perfect. But they'll say this seems like a reasonable thing that they're trying to do here, just in terms of money. You know, we've been doing this since 1988. So one of the things that they look at is this a project that has been done before? If it is something that's been done before, it's probably an important topic. But we don't need to keep repeating the same research projects over and over again. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that they look into. And then there's kind of, does it really fit sustainable agriculture? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of agriculture information out there and education and research that needs to be done. But sustainable agriculture is it's a bit of a different thing. So here at SARE, there's what we call the three pillars of sustainable agriculture. And that's a USDA definition of sustainable agriculture that is out there, which can be found if you just look up sustainable agriculture definition, USDA. But it needs to fit that definition of sustainable agriculture.
Okay. And I think a lot of people think of it as a three-legged stool. So, you know, you got your environmental sustainability, your financial, and your social sustainability. So who actually reviews these grants once you guys receive them?
So our grant reviewers are actually people who are not specifically associated with SARE. So they're not staff, they're not employed by the USDA. They apply to be a grant reviewer. And so they can be a lot of different people. It's something that if you're curious about the program, I would encourage you to apply to be a grant reviewer. It's really interesting. You'll get to see, you know, the specific applications and learn what that process looks like, the good things, you know, the things we want to see. But yeah, our grant reviewers are, a lot of them are from universities, a lot of them are farmers, a lot of them work for these nonprofits and different organizations. But the big thing is that they're not SARE employees.
Exactly. And what makes SARE different, I think, is that your reviewers come from come from a wide variety of walks. And, you know, for the people out there who may want to be a reviewer, let's say they've been ranching cattle for 20 years, but they may not want to apply to be a reviewer because they're thinking, I don't have a PhD. They're probably not going to accept me. Can you speak to that a little bit? What the qualifications and the type of folks who actually brought on to be reviewers?
Yeah. So I would say there's kind of three people that we look for when we look for what makes a good reviewer. So it's people who are new to the program that don't know anything about SARE. We honestly really like those people because they have a fresh opinion. You know, they're not biased based on what they've seen in the past about the program. And then, you know, kind of the opposite of that, there's a lot of people who are very familiar with the program that have either, you know, had grants in the past, they've worked with us, they've seen a lot of our publication and materials. A lot of people who review do that as well. And then there's also a lot of young researchers and a lot of young farmers and ranchers. People who are trying to find, you know, their place in the world and their path to move forward. It's a great thing to do because you get exposed to so much different information and different ideas in these grants. And so, yeah, it's not really that we have specific requirements of you have to have a PhD or have been farming for 10 years or, you know, have 57 cows. Like, there's not really specific requirements like that. Which is good because we get a lot of different people involved in the program. And again, I would encourage anybody who's curious about it to apply to be a grant reviewer, because that's how much we value having a unique set of eyes and a unique set of opinions on these grant applications that we get.
Yeah, and I guess it would always be a good way to learn how to, if you want to put in a grant, it's a great way to learn how to see what reviewers are going to be looking for. So as we wind up, once again, can you give us that deadline for the RNEs and the education grants?
June 4th is going to be the deadline for the research and education grants. And then May 7th is the deadline for the graduate student grants.
Okay, we didn't talk about the graduate student grants too much. Can you just quickly explain what those grants are targeted at?
Yeah, so they're exactly what they sound like. So they're intended for master's and PhD students who are enrolled in a graduate program at an accredited university who are doing research on sustainable agriculture. In my opinion, those are some of our coolest grant projects that we have, just because it's, you know, it's young people, it's new ideas. They're really trying something and putting themselves out there. But kind of the way they work, so the applications open in February, they'll end in May, and then in September, they'll be announced. And so, you know, if you're starting in the fall, you could receive the funding in the fall to do your project and then go all the way through the program. And so it really is helpful because it can fund essentially all of your master's research or your PhD research, which is not something that you can find in a lot of places.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a good tool for these young researchers to start to cut their teeth and do things with larger grants eventually. So any closing thoughts?
The big thing would be, if you have any questions about anything to do with the program, don't hesitate to reach out. You can find my contact information on our website, which is southern.sara.org.
Okay. Well, hopefully we'll get a bunch of applications due to this interview. But I want to thank you for taking the time, Ian, and have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.